It's now my pleasure on your behalf to call on our brother Peter to speak to us on the book of Nahum, to give us his second class. Brother Peter.
Good evening, everyone. As mentioned, of course, we'll be looking at part two of our study of Nahum tonight. I considered giving Jonathan the opportunity to speak this evening as he missed his chance last week, but that's okay. I do like sharing, but that's okay. We're here. We'll start this evening off with a brief review of where we left our class 2 weeks ago. We looked at a lot of background and history and charts and timelines and so on last week, a lot of background to the prophecy to really help us to understand some of the implications and really the meanings of what was behind what was said in the prophecy. And following that, we will then get right into the text itself, and we'll look at a breakdown of the prophecy. We will try and compare some of the ideas contained within Nahum to other scriptures elsewhere in the Bible. And hopefully we'll be able to get some personal lessons from it. Hopefully we'll be able to relate what we say this evening to us. Nahum is quite a unique prophetic book, really, when compared to a lot of the other prophets. Not once in the book are Israel or Judah rebuked. Not once are they reproved for their iniquity. Not once are they told to repent or suffer the consequences, like is so evident in so many of the other prophets. In fact, quite the opposite is true. And the book sounds like it could be straight out of the Psalms, where David expresses his trust and his confidence in the Lord. And the entire message, really, of this book of Nahum, is one of comfort to those who are troubled or oppressed. And that's, of course, what his name means. What Nahum means is comfort. So just to bring us up to speed again as to where we left off 2 weeks ago, we looked at some of the history of the nation of Assyria, some of the facts which have been discovered through archaeology. We looked at a few of its kings. In particular, we talked about Tiglath-Pileser III, who invaded the northern kingdom of Israel on a few occasions. We looked a little bit about Sargon II, who was responsible for the final captivity of the northern kingdom during the reign of Hezekiah. We looked a little bit at Sennacherib, who was very famous, of course, who besieged Jerusalem in the time of Hezekiah, and we know his army was slain by an angel of the Lord. And we also looked at Ashurbanipal, under whose reign the Assyrian Empire was its greatest. And it's also in his reign, it's also in the reign of Ashurbanipal that is believed that Nahum gave his prophecy, right at the very peak of the power and the territorial extent of the Assyrian Empire. Now, we just should turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 33 for also a little bit of background. It's interesting that Nahum does not mention any king of Israel or of Judah in his prophecy anywhere. And it's interesting that at one point there was, in fact, no king. And we'll read in 2 Chronicles chapter 33 and verse 11. This is in the time of Manasseh. Wherefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. So for a brief period of time, there was in fact no king over Judah. And it's suggested that that's perhaps the reason why Nahum does not mention a king, that it's in fact in this exact time frame. Maybe it's speculation, but a lot of the other dates really seem to line up. So that's just some more background. It's kind of interesting. The Assyrians certainly played a dominating role in the lives of the people of Judah. Perhaps 60 years or so previous to the book of Nahum, the armies of Sennacherib had surrounded the walls of Jerusalem, only to be destroyed by the angel of the Lord. Now, now the king Manasseh was deposed from the throne. He was bound. He was in prison. He was in Babylon. Imagine the situation in the land at the time. The Assyrians were fierce and powerful. They were very, very well known for their cruelty and their ruthlessness. The king, of course, a symbol of strength, was in prison in Babylon. The country would have been unsettled, to say the least. Perhaps there was violence. Perhaps it was like Iraq is today, filled with chaos. If there was ever a time of uncertainty, a time of fear, it was now. One man stands up, and this is what he has to say. God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take his vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserveth wrath for his enemies. Those words would have lit up the people's hearts like a lighthouse on a stormy night. And so we're introduced to Nahum. Now, the book itself can be relatively easily divided up into three main components. And the chapters, the three chapters of Nahum, follow this breakup. Chapter 1 describes God's power and his unrivaled supremacy. Chapter 2 talks about the destruction of Nineveh and the absoluteness of that destruction. And chapter 3 goes into some of the reasons why God decided to completely wipe Assyria or Nineveh off the map. So let's start in chapter 1 then, and we'll just read verses 2 to 5. We have a little, an interesting little section here describing God's character. So Nahum chapter 1 verses 2 to 5. God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserveth wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry, and drieth up all the rivers. Bashan languisheth, and Carmel and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence, yea, the world and all that dwell therein. Just a brief snippet of the power of God and a bit of his character. Now, there's some key words we'd like to take out of verse 2. Jealous, revengeth, furious, vengeance, and wrath. And it's interesting, these aren't particularly desirable characteristics of a disciple. In fact, if we turn to Galatians chapter 5, and verses 19 down to 21, these are some of the works of the flesh. Now, the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. So this is interesting. And how can we reconcile this? Is God a sinner? Of course not. So let's look a little bit more closely at these attributes then. Look at them a little more in detail and see what it's really trying to say. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5, and we'll come in at verse 6 and read down to verse 10. I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Thou shalt have none other gods before me. Thou shalt not make thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the waters beneath the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Jealousy is because God alone is God. The reason jealousy is used in this passage in Nahum against Nineveh was because of their false religion, because of their many idols and their graven images and likenesses and so on, all these things that we just read in Deuteronomy, which were an abomination to God. And God was about to prove to them that there was one God, and that God was the God of Israel, and that he was supreme. This jealousy, interestingly enough, also alludes to the protection of a wife by her husband. God would protect Judah, and in the role of a husband, avenge her of the defilement she received at the hand of the Assyrians. We also have the phrase, "the Lord revengeth," as the next of our key words. Now, this is not as much retaliation as we humans see revenge. We think of revenge as out to as getting our own back for something done to us. God sees it as more of vindication for evil against him. And this is done in justice and in a very organized fashion. It's not in blind rage as with humans. Often God's vengeance is talked about in the way of a set time or a fixed day that suits him. We'll just turn to a couple of verses in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 61 and verse 2. We'll start at verse 1. "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prisons to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn." And in this instance, it's vengeance, when it's talked about God's vengeance, it's specifically on a day. Similarly, in Isaiah chapter 63, over a page, Isaiah chapter 63 and verse 4, "For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come." So it's very much organized. It's not, as we mentioned before, it's not blind rage. It's not a lashing out on God's part. It's very set and organized. Finally, let's turn to Romans chapter 12 on this subject. And verse 19, which says, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." Revenge is for God. The Jerusalem Bible renders this, "Never try to get revenge. Leave that, my friends, to God's anger." I have an interesting note here that I scribbled down a while ago in my margin. It's interesting, the second word here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 19 is beloved. And that is the meaning of David's name. And we all know the story of David and Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25. We won't turn there. But it's interesting that that's what happened with David. He completely missed this concept. And when Nabal spurned him, he freaked out. And he lost it. And he was about to go and wipe the guy out. Maybe he deserved it. That's not the point. And the point is brought out very clear for us here in Romans chapter 12. "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." So back in Nahum, as we continue to read in chapter 1 and verse 2, we get to the next phrase, "and is furious." Now, the margin in the Oxford King James, which I have here, renders it that "hath fury." And I think this is actually a little bit more accurate, and it really means that God is the possessor of wrath and that he is the master of it, and man is not. Proverbs tells us, of course, to avoid a man of wrath. Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 4. Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 4, "Circumcise yourselves to the Lord, and take away the foreskins of your heart, ye men of Judah, and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my fury come forth like fire and burn that none can quench it because of your evil doings. And in Lamentations chapter 4, we have a similar thought. Lamentations chapter 4 and verse 11. The Lord hath accomplished his fury. He hath poured out his fierce anger and hath kindled a fire in Zion and hath devoured the foundations thereof. God's wrath is as if it's an entity. It's as if he's got a bowl of wrath that is totally in his control and he can choose when to pour it out if necessary. He reserved it, interestingly enough, when Nineveh repented at the preaching of Jonah. He was completely prepared to wipe out the city, but because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, he withheld his wrath at that point. But as they became too proud, he chose to pour it out and destroy them, as described to us by Nahum. Now, these things we've considered here in verse 2 are really confirmed in verse 3 of Nahum chapter 1. God is fully in control. He makes it abundantly clear that he is to be feared for his power. But of course, he is consistent with the character which he showed to Moses in the mount. Verse 3, the Lord is slow to anger. He is great in power and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. And we know in Exodus chapter 34, which is where he showed his glory or his character to Moses, he said very similar things. Exodus chapter 34, verses 5 to 7. And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and the fourth generations. Just as a bit of an aside, there are some very interesting similarities in this first chapter of Nahum, as there are with another great deliverance for the children of Israel. And that, of course, is their rescue from the land of Egypt. We have a couple of quotes here from Exodus chapter 15, which is the song of Moses after they were delivered from the Egyptians near the Red Sea. And maybe if you can keep your finger in both Nahum and Exodus chapter 15. As we look at Nahum chapter 1, verse 3, we have the Lord, in the middle of the verse, the Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. And we can think of course, the cloud as a pillar of fire by day. And also, if we look in Exodus chapter 15, verses 8 and 10, this is the song that Moses and the children of Israel sing after the Egyptians are drowned. Exodus chapter 15 and verse 8, and with the blast of thy nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright as an heap, and the depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. And in verse 10, thou didst blow with thy wind. The sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. We know, of course, that God has power over the wind when Jesus was able to calm the storm on Galilee. Back in Nahum and verse 4, he rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry and drieth up all the rivers. I think that's a pretty clear one when God made the path for the children of Israel to cross through the sea, the Red Sea. Verse 8 in Nahum, but with an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. Of course, once the Egyptians were in the middle of the water and the Israelites were safely to the other side, of course, the flood returned and completely wiped them out. Verse 10 of Nahum chapter 1, right at the end of the verse, it says, they shall be devoured as stubble, fully dry. Exodus chapter 15 and verse 7, and in the greatness of thine excellency, thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Thou sendest forth thy wrath, which consumeth them as stubble. And then in verse 13 in Nahum chapter 1, for now I will break his yoke from off thee and will burst thy bonds in sunder, which again is a very clear echo of the bondage that the children of Israel faced while they were in Egypt, which of course was broken by God when he led them out of Egypt. Now there's something else which is very interesting which we need to consider in Nahum chapter 1. And that is in verse 15. Because there is something here which is very, very relevant for us today. Verse 15, near the end of the verse, halfway through, it says, O Judah, keep thy solemn feasts, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee, he is utterly cut off. The people of Judah were exhorted to keep their solemn feasts and to perform thy vows. It's interesting, those two things. Vows are often made in times of trouble. And this was certainly a time of trouble for the people of Judah. We can think of other examples. Jephthah, he vowed to give to God the first thing that he saw when he returned home if God granted him the victory. Now we know that was his daughter. And he went through with that. He dedicated his daughter to God. We can think of Hannah, who in her tribulation, in her situation, if God would give her a son, she vowed to return that son to serve in the tabernacle. And we know, of course, that they did. We also have another rather interesting one in Jonah. When they were in the boat, the fishermen did everything they could, or the sailors did everything they could to overcome the storm, and they were not able until they threw Jonah in. And it says, when they saw the calm, they were amazed, they praised God, and they made vows. Which is it's quite interesting. But isn't that true with us? When we are troubled, when we're in very difficult situations, we realize in bold the power of God. We can see how helpless we are and how in need of salvation we are. We turn to God when we need help, and he will often deliver us at our request. But how often do we remember? When times are good again, when we've overcome the hurdle by God's help, do we remember? When we no longer feel strained or stressed, do we remember what we've promised to God? We pray for God's care on a journey, but do we thank him when we safely reach our destination? We forget, don't we? It's human nature. And we're in such peril in this age that we live in because we don't face very much danger or uncertainty. We can feel uncomfortable at times, some of us more than others, but we don't have a bloodthirsty, violent nation banging on our front doors. We're here tonight in perfect safety. Do we remember what we have promised to God? The vow of baptism, of course, because he certainly does not forget. So moving into chapter 2 then. Now, we're not going to look too deeply into chapter 2, save to point out how incredibly accurate the scriptures are. We touched on this a little last class, some of the prophecies, and we're going to go just a little bit deeper tonight. God promised that Nineveh's walls would be destroyed by a flood. It's chapter 2, verse 6. The gates of the river shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved, and also in chapter 1, verse 8, but with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof. In fact, the walls of the city were breached by the rising flow of the two rivers near Nineveh. We looked last week, it was near the Tigris. I can't remember off the top of my head the name of the other river, but there was another river that went through the middle of the city. And they can prove from archaeology that, in fact, those rivers overflowed their banks and eroded the walls of the city, enabling the attacking forces to get in. And it's remarkable how accurate the scriptures are. God also promised that its buildings would burn with fire. In chapter 2, verse 13, behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messenger shall be no more heard. Also in chapter 1, verse 10. For while they be folded together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble, fully dry. Archaeology shows the charred remains of buildings, including ash. In some places, it's 2 inches thick. God also promised that Nineveh's inhabitants would fail while trying to escape in chapter 2, verse 8. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. And historians confirm the death of all those who were living within the city. God also promised that the attackers would be dressed in red, which is in chapter 2, verse 3. The shield of the mighty is made red, and valiant men are in scarlet. The Medes, the nation, along with the Babylonians who destroyed Nineveh, the Medes wore scarlet-colored uniforms. Plunder and pillage would follow, God also promised, in chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Take ye the spoil of silver and the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store and the glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness. Under Sennacherib, the Assyrians gathered much wealth, and even more so under the reign of Ashurbanipal. The nation and Nineveh and a couple of the palaces within Nineveh were unbelievably wealthy. The stores of gold and silver and precious stones were unbelievable. They've excavated some of the ruins of Sennacherib's palace, and some of all the walls were covered in these massive reliefs of battles and so on, and all the escapades of the Assyrians. But the wealth that they had was amazing. And every item of value was removed from the city and was carried away by the conquerors, by the Medes and the Babylonians. God also promised that prior to this attack, Nineveh would be drunk in chapter 1, verse 10. For while they be fallen together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards. And also in chapter 3, verse 11. Thou also shalt be drunken, and thou shalt be hid. Thou also shalt seek strength because of the enemy. History records that they were, in fact, inebriated at the time of the crucial attack. And I've got an excerpt here, which I'll read for you in a minute. God also promises that the destruction of Nineveh would be final, would be absolute. Chapter 1, verse 9. What do you imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. And also in verse 14. And the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name be sown. Out of the house of thy God will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. Nineveh has never been rebuilt. In fact, the books of Nahum and Jonah by critics up until the mid-1800s were considered to be false because there was absolutely no record whatsoever of Nineveh anywhere. It's only, I think it was in 1847 that they made a first discovery, archaeology of Nineveh. And it was only after that point that there's been any credibility by critics ascribed to Jonah and Nahum, because they just thought Nineveh never existed. So complete and absolute was the destruction of it. So I have this book, Nahum the Comforter, and in the back there's an excerpt from Diodorus Siculus. It was a Greek historian of about the first century. And he writes some interesting things here. He talks a lot about the battles and the confederacy between the Medes, the Babylonians, and some of the other people around, some Arabs and so on, as they came to the final destruction of Nineveh. And I think there was three main battles in which this confederacy of Babylonian, Medo-Babylonian, is that the right term? They were actually defeated three times, which led to a massive party in the Assyrian camp, in which they were all drunk. I don't know if that bit is in here. No, that's, yeah, in which they were all drunk. And so when the Medes and Babylonians and their other accomplices attacked for the fourth time, they were able to completely take over because the Assyrian army was drunk, just as it says, as prophesied in Nahum. So we'll just read a little bit here. This guy is Greek, Diodorus Siculus, so he's put Greek names in place of some of the names that we may be familiar with. So Sardanapalus, who was the king of Nineveh at the time, king of the Assyrian Empire, realizing that his entire kingdom was in great danger, sent his three sons and two daughters together with much of his treasure to Paphlagonia to the governor Cotta, who was the most loyal of his subjects, while he himself, dispatching letter carriers to all his subjects, summoned forces and made preparations for the siege of the city. The Medes and Babylonians had come to lay siege to Nineveh. Now there was a prophecy which had come down to him from his ancestors. No enemy will ever take Ninus, which is Nineveh, by storm, unless the river shall first become the city's enemy. Assuming, therefore, that this would never be, he held out in hope, his thoughts being to endure the siege and await the troops which would be sent from his subjects. The rebels, who were the Medes and Babylonians with their other accomplices, elated at their success, their defeat of the armies of Assyria, they pressed the siege, but because of the strength of the walls, they were unable to do any harm to the men of the city, for neither engines for throwing stones, nor shelters for sappers, nor battering rams devised to overthrow walls had as yet been invented at the time. Moreover, the inhabitants of the city had a great abundance of all provisions, since the king had taken thought on that score. Consequently, the siege dragged on, and for 2 years they pressed their attack, making assault on the walls and preventing the inhabitants of the city from going out into the country. But in the 3rd year, after there had been heavy and continuous rains, it came to pass that the Euphrates, it's actually the Tigris, running very full, both inundated a portion of the city and broke down the walls for a distance of 20 stades. I'm not sure how far a stade is. At this, the king, believing that the oracle, that prophecy had been fulfilled, and that the river had plainly become the city's enemy, abandoned hope of saving himself, and in order that he might not fall into the hands of the enemy, he built an enormous pyre in his palace, heaped upon it all his gold and silver, as well as every article of the royal wardrobe, and then shutting his concubines and eunuchs in the room, which had been built in the middle of the pyre, he consigned both them and himself and his palace to the flames. The rebels, on learning of the death of Sardanapalus, took the city by forcing an entrance where the wall had fallen, and clothing Arbaces, who I believe was the Babylonian leader, in the royal garb, saluted him as king and put in his hands supreme authority. So this is an excerpt from a Greek historian around the first century. And it's remarkable how accurate it is when you read through what history has recorded and all these things. It's exactly what Nahum prophesied by God's direction. It's quite remarkable how accurate the scriptures are. And of course, none of this was really discovered until 150 years ago when they actually excavated Nineveh. Chapter 3 basically lays out for us God's justification for his judgments on Nineveh. There are several reasons. Lies in verse 1. Woe to the bloody city, it is full of lies and robbery. The Assyrians were famous for their deceit. And we have an example of this in the scriptures, actually, in 2 Kings chapter 18. Second Kings chapter 18 and verse 13, which is in the reign of Hezekiah. In the 14th year of Hezekiah, in fact, 2 Kings chapter 18 verse 13. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah, and he took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, I have offended, return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So the Assyrians placed a tribute on Hezekiah, but we know they completely ignored that. We continue on verse 17. The king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host. So Hezekiah just sent to the king of Assyria saying, I'm sorry, you know, I'll give you what you want, go away. He says, okay, give me all this. So Hezekiah gives him this great treasure, and he takes it and says, thanks, but I'm still going to kill you. Or so we thought anyways. So this is just a little insight into how the Assyrians worked. They were liars and deceitful. It's also called a bloody city, Nineveh, in chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the bloody city. And in verse 4, we read, because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts that selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts. So these are some of the things that that God condemns condemns Nineveh for. Also, we read in verse 8, art thou better than populous No? In the King James, the margin says No Ammon. And I think some versions put Thebes in there, and that's what it is, Thebes, which was a great city in Upper Egypt. Assyria sacked this city, and they completely destroyed it, as actually described here. We'll read it. Art thou better than populous Thebes, that was situate among the rivers, that had the waters round about it, whose rampart was the sea, and her walls was from the sea? Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and it was infinite. Put and Lubim were thy helpers. Yet was she carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed in pieces at the top of all the streets, and they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. And these are the things that the Assyrians did to the inhabitants of Thebes. And God challenges them here. He says, Assyria, are you better than these people that you have, that you've destroyed? Of course, it's a rhetorical question, and we know the answer is no. So the Assyrians were obviously incredibly proud as well. They were, and as such, by some of their writings and the palaces and the reliefs that they carved on their walls, it's evident that they were incredibly proud. Now, hopefully, none of us here can relate to a bloody city, to brutally murdering thousands of people. Hopefully, none of us also can relate to lying or being proud, but I think, unfortunately, we probably can. It's in our nature. But we know also that God hates it, and he violently destroyed, utterly destroyed, a city, the city of Nineveh, because of these things. Now, we would be misguided if we thought that we'd be exempt from God's punishment if we share these traits of lying and of pride. And this is a lesson that we can take from the book of Nahum. God is just. We looked at his character in Exodus. He will by no means clear the guilty. And this is a good warning for us to watch our characters. It's interesting also to note about the Assyrians, that God used them as a tool to punish Israel and Judah. Yet their part in God's plan did not excuse them from their guilt. And that's quite an interesting thought for us to consider today. Clearly, by the fact that we are here, is evidence that in one form or another, we are part of God's plan. Now, that fact alone, however, means nothing when concerned with our salvation. Just because we are here, just because we are a part of God's plan in whatever form that may be, does not guarantee our salvation. And that's a lesson we learned from the Assyrians and from Nineveh. They were a part of God's plan. God used them as his tool to punish his people, but that did not exempt them from their wickedness. Now, it's also interesting to note that God was not evil or unjust to condemn the Ninevites. He clearly gave them a chance through the preaching of Jonah, to which they actually heeded, but only for a short time. And God also gives us that chance, and it is up to us to heed and to keep heeding his call. So we've reviewed a little of the background to this small book. We've considered a few key phrases Which brings us to perhaps what is the key phrase in Nahum, which is in chapter 1 and verse 7. This perhaps sums up everything that he has said and everything that he means. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. This verse would have overrode all the fear and insecurities of the people of Judah. At a time when the Assyrian nation was a real threat to their personal safety, these words would have carried incredible power. It would have brought back to them God's victory over the Egyptians, and who knows how many psalms and songs of David, which he spoke concerning God's deliverance. The message of Moses to Joshua, be strong and of a good courage, and so on. And it certainly could override everything for us today if we choose to meditate on it. We know that we are about to enter a time of trouble such as never has been on the face of the earth. And hopefully this message of Nahum will be one which will afford us strength when we need it.